the time when you should begin and finish each one. For an exam with many questions, divide the exam into equal fourths, then jot down the time you should begin and end each section. In both cases, these recorded times will keep you updated on how close your current progress matches your predetermined schedule. Why do we subtract 10 minutes in the first step? This provides a safety buffer. You want a few extra minutes available here and there to be able to double-check your answers when you are finished, or go back and add more insights to questions on which you were rushed. Strategy number 3. Proceed from easy to hard. Straight-A students almost never answer exam questions in the order that they are presented. Years of informal experimentation by successful students have demonstrated that the most effective way to tackle an exam is to answer the easiest questions first, and this is exactly what you should do. Start with the most approachable questions before moving on to the more forbidding. Don't worry if this has you skipping around all over the exam. In most cases, the provided order is irrelevant. The advantage of this approach is that it first focuses your energy on the questions you know the most about, ensuring that you get maximum points on these. It also gives you a better chance of conquering the more difficult ones. "I always skip a question if it does not come to me immediately," explains Ryan from Dartmouth. "This keeps my mind clear to answer other questions, and hopefully something will jog my memory." When you come across something hard early on in the exam, your natural instinct is to panic. You have so many more questions to finish, and you can almost feel the minutes ticking away as you stare blankly at this one particular roadblock. It can be tough to get your focus back to wring out as many points as possible from the easier questions that follow. If instead you tackle this same roadblock at the end of the exam, you'll find that the situation seems less dire. You've answered everything else, so all that's left to do is working out this final puzzler. More often than not, you will find the mental block diminished. Without the pressure of other questions looming in the background, you can take a more relaxed approach. You might not know the best answer, but you can spend some time to devise a reasonable answer. Because you have nothing else left to finish, you can spend the remainder of the time polishing this answer, thinking and repolishing. The result is the strongest possible outcome given your state of preparation. Strategy number 4. Outline essays. When facing an essay question, don't just start writing and see what happens. This approach leads to rambling answers and missed concepts. Instead, your first step should be to jot down a quick outline. This might seem like a waste of time, but in truth, it can be invaluable. First, reread the question carefully. As Matthew from Brown explains, usually you can isolate 3 or 4 mini questions from a single essay question. Underline each of these mini questions. This will help you flesh out your outline and avoid an incomplete answer. Then, outline on paper, not in your head, the way that you will use what you know to answer these mini questions, continues Matthew. To do so, use the margin of the exam to jot down all of the points you can recall that are relevant to the question. Record only a few keywords for each point to save time and space. For example, if you want to mention an argument made by an author named Robert Caro dealing with Lyndon Johnson's views on race relations, you might jot down Caro, race. Next, go back and check the question parts you underline in the first step. Make sure each is adequately addressed by the points you just noted in the margin. When you're sure that you have identified all the relevant information for the essay, number these points in the order that you want to present them. Only now should you begin writing your essay. Follow your outline, and the writing will proceed smoothly. You should be able to quickly produce a solid response that draws on everything you reviewed and addresses all parts of the question asked. Strategy number 5. Check your work. At the end, explains Chris from Dartmouth, I always check my answers. If you have extra time at the end of the exam, may you be so lucky, then follow Chris's advice and go back and check your work. You will be surprised by how many times this final review turns up a mistake in a technical problem or an important concept that you forgot to mention in an essay. If, after your first round of review, you still have time left over, then go through and check again. If there is a problem you feel particularly shaky on, use this time to go over it in detail, augmenting the answer wherever appropriate. Don't worry about using carrots and arrows to add in new phrases and facts to your essays or to point out added steps in your technical problems. Neatness doesn't count on exams. It's the content that matters. It's tempting to relax after finishing your exam, perhaps walking proudly to the front of the classroom and handing it in before anyone else. But aside from the wistful stares of your classmates, this strategy is ill-conceived. Double-checking your work up to the last minute can make the difference between an above-average student and an academic star. The plan in action. Now let's look at how the steps for Part 2 play out in the real world. This section presents two realistic case studies, both demonstrating how a hypothetical student uses straight-A strategies to prepare for an exam. You'll notice that each student has a couple of curveballs thrown into the mix. For example, Julie has a big paper due the same Monday as her midterm, so she can't simply cram all weekend. And Michael doesn't even start his review until a couple of days before the exam. The key here is to notice the flexibility with which these students apply the advice. This underscores the main lesson of these case studies. A study system is only as useful as your ability to adapt it to your unique situation. Both of our students managed to fit their review into an already busy schedule and do so without ever cramming, pulling all-nighters, or even spending more than a few hours studying on any given day. Case study number one. Julie's history midterm. The final grade for Julie's history class is based only on a midterm, a final, and one paper. Therefore, her performance on this upcoming midterm is important. The following timeline of Julie's preparation will give you a feel for how she spreads out the necessary work for optimal results. Monday, 2 weeks before the midterm. At the beginning of class, the professor issues a quick reminder about the upcoming exam. Taking advantage of the situation, Julie raises her hand to ask what it will cover and in what format. The professor offers the following information. The exam will consist mainly of essay questions. The topics will be broad, but the student will need to draw support from the reading assignments. There will also be a timeline section that will present a group of historical events covered in the class and then ask the student to rearrange them into chronological order. Now that Julie has a better feel for what to expect, she can construct a rough study schedule. Her biggest problem is that she has a big paper due for another class on the same day as the midterm. This prevents her from using the weekend before the exam as a big cram session, the strategy used by most students. She's going to have to figure out a way to tackle her preparation in advance. Julie decides that she will start her review this upcoming weekend, a little more than a week before the exam. Specifically, she will use this weekend to organize the necessary materials, which shouldn't take long. She will then use the week that follows to actually do the review, spreading the work out into little chunks so she won't get behind in her other obligations. That's all the time that she can spare. In particular, notice that she hasn't scheduled any studying for the Saturday and Sunday right before the big exam. She expects this time to be consumed with paper writing. To implement this plan, she follows the advice of Part 1 and records the details on her calendar, writing on each day what work she should accomplish. This will save her a lot of stress. Most students spend the week or so before an exam constantly worried about whether they should be studying and whether they have enough time left to prepare. Julie, on the other hand, is free from these worries. All she has to do is look at her calendar each morning and schedule a time for whatever piece of the study process she finds recorded for the day. Saturday, 9 days before the midterm. Julie's busy. As on most weekends, she has a lot of schoolwork to finish for Monday, and she also has some ambitious social plans for the evening, so her time is certainly limited. The goal of this weekend is to organize her history materials, which thankfully doesn't demand a lot of hard thinking. Julie hopes to get some relaxation out of her 2 days off. She consults her calendar. Today, Saturday, she should print hard copies of all the relevant notes and then prepare the memorization aids for the timeline section. Tomorrow, Sunday, she will focus her energy on constructing the practice quizzes for her notes. First, Julie sets aside an hour before lunch to print out the lecture and reading notes she made during the first half of class. She gathers the printouts, stashes them in a folder, then she heads off to meet some friends for lunch. Later that afternoon, she sets aside another half hour to work on her memorization aids. Fortunately, all of the major events discussed in the lectures were also described in the class textbook. Though most of these events were covered in much more detail in the other reading assignments, to construct a simple list of events, and their respective dates, requires only a quick scan through of this one book. As she comes across each relevant event, she jots the name on one side of an index card and then puts the date on the other side. Sunday, 8 days before the midterm. Mid-morning, a slightly groggy Julie, it was an eventful Saturday night, pulls herself out of bed, snags her laptop, her folder of note printouts, and a large coffee, and then heads to one of her favorite secret study spots. Being early on a Sunday, at least early relative to the typical college student schedule, the library is deserted, just the way she likes it. Getting down to business, Julie first sorts her notes into piles by subject. Some notes, of course, seem to straddle multiple subjects. That's okay. The piles are just a rough form of organization. Nothing has to be exact here. She ends up with 6 piles, which together constitute her study guide for the midterm. Julie then goes through each printout in her first pile, typing quiz questions on her laptop as she proceeds. Sometimes she copies questions straight off her notes. Other times she puts down a more general question that covers several smaller points described in her notes. It doesn't really matter exactly how she chooses the quiz questions, just as long as the questions being typed into her laptop more or less cover every important point discussed in the notes. After about an hour and a half, Julie has finished typing up quizzes for the first 3 of her 6 piles. She breaks for lunch, then returns later in the afternoon and spends another 2 hours constructing her quizzes. Once she's done, she prints out all 6 and attaches them to their corresponding piles. Though Julie's goal for the day was only to organize, the very act of constructing these quizzes has forced her to do a quick review of all the relevant course material, an important first step in internalizing all the necessary information. Monday through Friday, the week before the midterm. On Monday, as dictated by her calendar, Julie spends 2 hours mastering the first 2 quizzes, a task she accomplishes by pacing around her dorm room and lecturing answers to an imaginary class. Needless to say, Julie waited for a time when her roommate was out before starting this vocal review. On Tuesday, she works with her memorization flashcards for 45 minutes. On Wednesday, she spends 2 hours mastering the middle 2 quizzes. On Thursday, she spends another hour with her memorization flashcards, and on Friday, she spends 2 hours mastering the final 2 quizzes. As one might expect, even though she had previously eliminated most question marks in her notes by following the advice of Step 5, invest in academic disaster insurance, Julie comes across a handful of questions that she still doesn't really have a satisfactory answer for. She jots down these questionable topics, vowing to deal with them later. Saturday, 2 days before the midterm. Julie had hoped to finish studying before this weekend, but she was busier than she had expected the previous week, so she still has a little more to review. Because she also has a paper deadline on Monday, she knows that, at most, she can spare maybe an hour today for exam preparation. She uses this hour to finish her academic disaster insurance investment. Specifically, she takes the list of questions for which she doesn't have great answers and sends emails to classmates in hopes of soliciting better ones. By the end of the day, she has received responses of varying levels of detail for most of her outstanding questions. She doesn't feel great about her knowledge on these few points, but at least now she has something to say if it comes down to it. Monday, the day of the midterm. Notice that while most of her classmates sacrificed the entire weekend studying, Julie did little more than send a few emails over the last couple of days, leaving her free to focus on her paper. Now that it's the day of the midterm, she still doesn't have much serious preparation pending. During the morning, she shuffles through her memorization flashcards a couple of times and dips into her quizzes at random, answering a half dozen questions just to boost her confidence. She's rested and ready to go. Finally, it's time for the exam, and Julie knows exactly what to do. First, she zips right to the chronology section and makes quick work of the listed events. Her flashcards prepared her well. Then she reviews the four essay questions that follow. She constructs a time budget and tackles the questions in order of difficulty. Her quizzes set her up well to provide thorough, standout answers without too much wasted time thinking about what to say next. She is able to draw from several sources for each question, and because the information is so ingrained in her mind from her earlier quiz and recall sessions, she often finds herself being able to recall arguments almost word for word from her notes. And because she outlines her essays, she provides answers that pull in as much relevant information as possible and cover all pieces of the topic at hand. The aftermath. Julie nailed the chronology section and provided detailed and complete answers to each essay question. Obviously, she gets an A. And this doesn't at all surprise her. Later, when her friends, griping about their B exams, complain about how they spent all weekend studying, Julie kindly neglects to mention that she studied a grand total of 1 hour over the weekend, and no more than a few hours on any given day before that. Case study number two, Michael's calculus exam. Michael's taking a calculus class, and, as he's quick to admit, he doesn't like calculus. But as is the case at most colleges, a semester of calculus is required, so Michael's out of luck. The grade for this particular course is based on three exams and a bunch of problem sets. Let's see how Michael uses our system to overcome his lack of a natural affinity for the mathematical arts and pull off a strong grade without too much suffering. Monday, 4 days before the first exam. Yes, Michael's first calculus exam is less than a week away. By this point, as you'll recall, Julie was already well along in her preparation. But there are three things to remember here. One, this exam is not quite as big and as important as Julie's midterm. It covers only a third of the material, and its contribution to Michael's final grade is shared with two other tests and many problem sets. Second, many times, people have been known to allow exam dates to slip up on them. If you follow the advice from part one, this should not happen to you often, but it's important to see how the straight-A system can be adapted and applied even under these tight constraints. Finally, remember that Julie's exam date fell on the same day as a paper was due, so she had to be more conscientious with how she spread out her work. Because math professors tend to be precise, Michael doesn't need to ask about what the exam will cover. This information is spelled out in the syllabus. Specifically, the exam will draw from all material covered up until last Friday, which was when the professor handed back their last problem set. As you might imagine, Michael is somewhat stressed about the proximity of the exam, but this stress is mitigated significantly by his knowledge of our system. He knows that his next step is to marshal his resources, and that is what he is going to do tonight. Here's how he proceeds. The upcoming exam covers the first 4 weeks of the course. Because Michael had one problem set assigned each week, he now has four graded problem sets to use as the foundations for his mega problem sets. His first step is to extract sample problems from his notes to add to his existing graded problem sets. Following the strategy of step three, he grabs a blank sheet of paper for each of the 4 weeks of class. He then flips through his notebook and jots down sample problems from his notes onto the appropriate week's sheet of paper. Note, Michael is careful to label each question with the date of the lecture where he found it. This will make it easy to look up the answers in his notebook when it comes time to review. Finally, he attaches each sheet to the corresponding problem set. When he's done, Michael has four mega problem sets, each consisting of one graded problem set assignment from class and a sheet of paper filled with the sample problems from his notes. His final act of organization is to think up some technical discussion questions. For example, during the first week, Michael's class focused on single variable derivatives. So he jots down the following general question on his first mega problem set. Explain what a derivative is, what it describes, and the general procedure for calculating one when given a function. Remember, these general explanation questions are crucial. Without them, you run the danger of memorizing specific problems but not learning the technique behind the problems, ill-equipping you to handle the fresh problems you will face on the exam. Because he only has to cover 4 weeks of material, this process only takes about an hour to complete. Following our prohibition against organizing and reviewing on the same day, Michael calls it quits until tomorrow. Tuesday, 3 days before the exam. Michael's first class is at 11 a.m., so he drags himself out of bed at 8:30 a.m. to put in 2 hours of studying before his day really gets started. This is especially important because he has a busy afternoon and evening planned, and he is worried that he won't have any other free time to study today. He also believes in our philosophy of trying to finish as much work as possible as early as possible, so this decision comes naturally. By 9 a.m., Michael has settled into one of his favorite secluded study spots, a deserted upper floor of a small engineering library. He has a bowl of oatmeal in his stomach and a cup of coffee at his side, so you better believe that he's ready to work. It's time to start the quiz and recall process. Michael tries to provide answers for each of the questions contained in his first mega problem set. He uses a sheet of scratch paper and forces himself to jot down the important steps to each problem. For the technical explanation questions, he actually paces up and down the stacks, lecturing about the topics under his breath. After his first pass through, he takes a 10-minute break, then returns to tackle only the questions that gave him trouble. He continues until he has successfully answered every question. Because he is using the quiz and recall method, his focus is directed efficiently. He spends the most time this morning on the problems with which he has the most trouble, and the least time on the problems he understands well. Wednesday, 2 days before the exam. The exam looms 2 days in the future, and Michael has 3 more weeks' worth of material to master. Realizing the potential urgency of this situation, he carves out 2 separate 2-hour chunks of study for the day, giving him 4 total hours in which to work. The first chunk is in the morning, the second in the afternoon. The break in between will help Michael's brain recharge and prevent this task from becoming too mentally draining. As before, it takes Michael most of the first 2 hours to get through his second mega problem set. Once again, several passes were required, each one focusing on fewer and fewer problems. That afternoon, Michael knocks off the 3rd mega problem set during his second 2-hour block. In fact, because this material is more recent, he is able to finish in just 1.5 hours. Michael doesn't try to cram more work into this newly discovered free time. He has accomplished what he had hoped for the day. Thursday, 1 day before the exam. Michael feels good. Yes, the exam is tomorrow, but he has already applied the quiz and recall method to 3/4 of the material that he needs to learn. While many of his classmates have set aside this entire day, and probably night as well, for cramming, Michael, on the other hand, once again schedules only a couple of hours in the morning. It takes him a little over 1 hour to complete his final mega problem set. This material was covered just last week in class, so it's still fresh in his mind. And with the remaining time, he goes through his notes to retrieve the handful of question-marked topics that evaded his efforts as spelled out in Step 5, to explain them before the study process began. For each of these questions, Michael reduces his confusion to a set of concise statements along the lines of, "I don't understand the 4th step in the following problem from the 9:28:05 lecture notes." He then emails a friend in the class, someone who happens to have more natural math ability than Michael, asking if he can stop by to talk about the material. The friend agrees. That night, Michael stops by his friend's dorm room. Not surprisingly, the friend is bleary-eyed, surrounded by piles of notes, and just finishing the first several hours of what will undoubtedly become a late-night cram session. They discuss Michael's specific questions and clear up most of his confusion. The friend makes some comment about how brutal the studying will be, and Michael nods in agreement, choosing not, for the sake of their friendship, to mention that he hasn't even so much as looked at a calculus textbook since early that morning and has no intention of looking at one for the rest of the evening. Friday, day of the exam. If a practice exam had been available this morning, would be a great time for Michael to tackle it. Refreshed and prepared, Michael would have found the experience a confidence booster and a final check for any techniques he might have missed in his systematic review. Because no such practice exam exists, Michael creates his own, setting aside 45 minutes in the morning for a final review. Michael articulates out loud the explanations that he learned last night for his question-marked topics. He then goes back over a handful of the hardest problems from his mega problem sets, solving each one with ease. This boosts his confidence and puts his mind in the right state. That's it. He's ready to go. When the big moment arrives and the exams are finally handed out, Michael knows exactly how to proceed. He first sorts the questions in order of difficulty and then constructs a time budget. He gets off to a good start, providing solid answers to the easy problems that he tackles first. Soon, he is left with only a small number of tricky problems and a solid block of time in which to solve them. He begins work on the first of these hard prompts, but quickly finds himself stuck. He's having trouble finding a solution. Time marches forward. Incipient tinges of panic begin to nibble at his concentration. Michael realizes it's time to step back. He takes a deep breath. Remembering the test-taking strategies from step 6, he skips this problem and moves on to the next. He is able to get decent answers for the remaining hard problems. They aren't great answers, but they demonstrate his solid understanding of the underlying techniques. Now, with only 5 minutes to spare, Michael returns to his nemesis. It's still tricky. He still doesn't know exactly how to solve it, but the pressure is much lower now, because it's the only problem left. Michael can rid his mind of the distraction of other questions. This is all that remains. Even if he completely blanks and puts down nothing, the only damage done will be limited to one problem. That's not so bad. With the intensity of the situation lessened, Michael can think more clearly. And sure enough, he comes up with an idea of how to proceed. In the few minutes that remain, he carefully records some sensible steps toward a solution. It's by no means a complete or perfect response, but it's the best he can do under the circumstances. The aftermath. As is often the case, the problem that gave Michael so much trouble gave everyone else in the class trouble as well. Many of these other students, however, didn't have the resources to stay cool under pressure, the resources, of course, being Michael's test-taking strategies. Their consternation regarding this one devilish prompt led them to waste a lot of time, rush through the final problems, and make many careless mistakes. Michael, on the other hand, got credit for all of the problems that he knew and a good chunk of partial credit for the tricky problem. Because of the trouble his classmates had on this exam, his performance, though not perfect, was near the top of the heap. He receives an A. The lesson learned here is important. For technical exams, you can never guess how well you performed until you get your grade back. Problems that you couldn't solve may have stymied everyone else as well. Therefore, you need to lose the high school mentality that 90% to 100% of the points gets an A, and 80% to 89% of the points gets a B, and so forth. In technical classes, it's most likely that the professor grades on a curve so that the top 15% of scores, no matter how high or low they are, get A's. The next 20% get B's, and so on. For example, I've taken more than one technical exam where the average score was hovering around 50 points out of 100, and a score of 65 merited an A. I've seen exam questions that not a single person in the class got right. And I once got an A on an exam where I left a problem blank that was worth 25% of the points. You never know what's going to happen. This all leads to the following point. Never lose your cool. Michael did the right thing by ordering his problems according to their difficulty and then skipping past a particularly troubling one when it appeared. His goal was to get the maximum number of points possible, not to get every problem right, and the result was a strong grade. Part 2 Cheat Sheet. Step 1. Take smart notes. Always go to class and try to take the best notes possible. For non-technical courses, capture the big ideas by taking notes in the question evidence conclusion format. For technical courses, record as many sample problems and answers as possible. Step 2. Demote your assignments. Work a little bit each day on your assignments. Avoid suffering from day-before syndrome. Read only the favored sources on the syllabus in detail. To decide how much time to spend on supplemental sources, remember the importance hierarchy. Readings that make an argument are more important than readings that describe an event or person, which are more important than readings that only provide context, i.e. speech transcripts, press clippings. Take reading notes in the question evidence conclusion format. Work in groups on problem sets, solve problems on the go, and write up your answers formally the first time. Step 3. Marshal your resources. Figure out exactly what the test will cover. Cluster your notes for non-technical courses. build mega problem sets for technical courses. Step 4, conquer the material. Embrace the quiz and recall method. It's the single most efficient way to study. Spread out memorization over several days. Your mind can do only so much at a time. Step 5, invest in academic disaster insurance. Eliminate the question marks for topics covered in class or from the reading that you don't understand. Step 6, provide A-plus answers. Look over the whole test first. Figure out how much time you have to spend on each question, leaving a 10-minute cushion at the end. Answer the questions in order of increasing difficulty. Write out a mini outline before tackling an essay question. Use any and all leftover time to check and recheck your work. Part 3. Essays and Papers. I don't believe in sitting in front of a blank screen and just starting to write, hoping it will come to you. Anna, a straight-A college student. Paper writing is hard, and to some extent, this is unavoidable. A college-level paper requires you to sift through endless sources of information, identify insights, form arguments, and then translate the results of these efforts into clean, eloquent prose. In short, a good paper requires a good amount of serious thinking, and that takes time. Furthermore, this thinking can't all be reduced to a simple system. In high school, you probably had a nice, neat format that all papers could fit into. An introduction, which stated a thesis, followed by isolated supporting paragraphs, each providing one piece of evidence, and then finally a conclusion that reiterated the thesis. Those were the days. Unfortunately, this oversimplified system won't work in college. The thinking required for a college-level paper is much more complex. A format that works for an anthropology essay, for example, might be completely different from a format that works for a history research paper. A piece-by-piece presentation of evidence might be appropriate for one class, but multiple intertwined narratives might be better for another. Each assignment is a fresh challenge, and each demands a lot of attention and care. However, there is hope. Paper writing is hard. But the good news is that it doesn't have to be as hard as most students make it. Let's begin by taking a closer look at the paper writing process itself, which can be broken down into 3 separate components. 1, sifting through existing arguments. 2, forming your own argument. 3, communicating your argument clearly. Most students approach paper writing by combining all 3 of these components into one drawn-out and bloated process. They sit down at their computer, stack up some sources, and then begin writing with only a vague idea of where they're headed. Whenever their argument stalls, they flip through their sources until they find an interesting quote. They insert this quote into their document, and then let their argument continue in this new direction for a while until it stalls once again, at which point it's back to the sources. This cycle of research, think, write continues slowly for hours as the paper is constructed one painful paragraph at a time. As you can imagine, this process is incredibly draining. Each of the 3 components just described is mentally taxing, but to do all 3 at the same time is downright exhausting. The straight-A approach, on the other hand, is to separate these components into distinct challenges, each of which can be handled by a fine-tuned and efficient system. Each of the 3 components remains difficult, but by separating them and applying systematic strategies to each, no part of the paper writing process comes even close to the agonizing approach employed by most students. As Gretchen, a straight-A student from Skidmore, emphasizes, the key to effective paper writing is breaking down the task into manageable units. The straight-A strategy is made up of 8 steps. We start by discussing how to find a topic that will hold your interest and how to locate a thesis within the topic that is both interesting and supportable. From there, we move on to the research effort. This step is crucial. As research, perhaps more than any other part of the paper writing process, is where the most time can be wasted. We present a streamlined system for gathering and annotating the right material as quickly as possible. After research comes argument construction. There is, unfortunately, no simple system that guarantees a smart argument. But we do describe helpful strategies for gathering feedback on your argument and recording it in an outline format that best facilitates the steps that follow. Next comes the writing. At this point, you have already figured out exactly what you are going to say and how you are going to support it, so this step has been reduced to constructing clear prose for a well-understood argument. As a result, we don't spend much time here. The sooner you dispel the notion that writing is the most important part of paper writing, the easier it will become for you to reap the benefits of the straight-A approach. Anna, a straight-A student from Dartmouth, sums this up succinctly when she notes, "Once I have the structure, the paper writes itself." Finally, we tackle editing. Some students spend too little time on this step and subsequently hand in papers with stupid grade-busting mistakes. Other students spend way too much time on this step and thus make the paper writing process much longer than it need be. To alleviate these problems, we conclude Part 3 with a specific 3-pass process that will consistently transform your paper into something worthy of submission without wasted effort. Don't be intimidated by the number of steps. Many of them describe very short and quite painless procedures, such as finding a topic or asking your professor for his opinion of your thesis. We separate these small pieces into their own steps, however, because it allows us to focus on their importance and gives you a plan for completing them, even if their time demands are minimal. One last note. Not all papers are made equal. Writing assignments can vary from a 3-page analysis of a book chapter to a 50-page mini dissertation based on exhaustive research. In recognition of this variation, we distinguish 2 different types of writing assignments: research papers and critical analysis essays. The steps that follow will discuss both of these types separately to ensure that your paper writing process is as efficient and targeted as possible for each specific assignment. Research papers versus critical analysis essays. Writing assignments come in many varieties. Some require a lot of original research, whereas others require only a critical discussion of a topic introduced in class. Some have ulcer-inducing length requirements, whereas others ask for only a handful of pages. We capture these differences with the simple classification scheme of research papers versus critical analysis essays. Some assignments, of course, may fall outside of these 2 descriptions, but for the most part, they capture the major variations in paper writing. All of the advice that follows explicitly describes which of these 2 types it applies to. Research papers. A research paper requires you to choose a topic within provided parameters and then devise an original thesis relevant to your chosen topic. For example, the broad parameters for your topic choice might be anything involving the British Empire. The specific topic you choose from within these parameters might be public schools and the British Empire. And the thesis you choose might be the public school system in 19th century England had a curriculum specifically tailored to the requirements of the British Empire. Research papers require original research to support your original thesis, and accordingly, their page lengths are long and their due dates are generally a ways off from when they are assigned. If you spread out the work appropriately and choose the right topic, research papers can provide a rewarding intellectual challenge. Proposing and supporting an original argument is exciting. However, if left until the last minute, these assignments can become a nightmare. More than a few students have suffered a nervous breakdown from the stress of tackling a major research paper at the last moment. So for these assignments in particular, take careful note of the scheduling recommendations that follow. Critical analysis essays. Critical analysis essays are the bread and butter of most liberal arts classes. These essays are short, and they typically require you to analyze one or more of your class reading assignments. They are often set up as a comparison. For example, how do Nordlinger and Hopkins differ in their approach to understanding American isolationism? What cultural and theological sources account for these differences? Critical analysis essays differ from research papers in several significant ways. Topics are provided in advance. Your thesis is nothing more than a specific answer to the question asked in the assignment, and there is little to no original research required. Not surprisingly, these essays require less time to complete than research papers. Their goal is to test your understanding of the material presented in class, not to seek out and present new ideas. Don't get the wrong idea. These essays are not necessarily easier than research papers. College writing assignments follow a simple rule. The required precision of your thinking works in direct proportion to the constraint of the material. That is, the more specific the assignment, the more subtle and detailed your thinking must be. So beware. If your assignment covers only one chapter, then you're going to need to understand every word of that chapter and be able to articulate your analysis with precision. Step 1. Target a titillating topic. Remember, a topic does not equal a thesis. A topic describes an interesting subject or area of observation. A thesis presents an interesting, specific argument about that subject or observation. Let's look at some examples. Listener beware. These thesis statements are the product of the author's imagination and are therefore more likely than not completely bogus. Use them at your own risk. Topic. There are interesting similarities between the art of Caspar David Friedrich and Washington Allston, even though they worked on different continents. Observation. Thesis. These similarities derive from Friedrich and Allston's shared connection to Samuel Taylor Coleridge and his prescient brand of early postmodern philosophy. Topic. The early work of Faulkner. Subject. Thesis. Faulkner's early style was influenced by the European modernists. Topic. During the first half of the 20th century, New York's Chinatown boomed while other immigrant communities struggled to find a financial foothold. Observation. Thesis. The cultural institutions of mainland China, when exported to American immigrant populations, provided a support system and organizational structure well suited to mitigate the specific challenges of building financial security in a new country. As mentioned, for a critical analysis essay, the topic is provided, so this step won't be applicable. For a research paper, however, you get to choose the topic, so we'll focus on the specific case of research paper topic selection for the remainder of this section. Choosing a research paper topic. Typically, the professor will provide some loose parameters. For an art history course, these might be any artist covered in the class so far. For a political science class, they might be economic policy and Latin America. The key is to choose a topic within the constraints of the assignment that excites you. All work that follows on your paper will stem from this topic. If you are not intrigued by the idea, then the paper writing process will be tedious. If, on the other hand, you are fascinated or at least curious, then the process will be that much easier. The best way to identify a titillating topic is to start looking for one early. I work on topic ideas in my head and on scraps of paper beginning anywhere from a week to a month in advance of the actual deadline for a paper, explains Doris, a straight-A Harvard student. Follow this approach. On the very first day of class, read the description of the research paper or papers that will be assigned. The syllabus should describe each paper's topic parameters, and the professor will usually discuss these assignments briefly early on in the term. Once you know the parameters for the paper, you should constantly be on the lookout for a particular subject or observation that interests you. If one reading assignment really grabs your attention, jot down the topic so you'll remember it later. If a professor poses an interesting question during class or piques your curiosity by describing a compelling open area of research, make a note of it. As Sean, a straight-A student from Yale, explains, keep an eye out for concepts that interest you in the readings and lectures. If there's something that grabs you, it will probably make a good topic. If you have trouble finding a topic in advance, you have two options. First, as Qian Wen, a straight-A student from Dartmouth, advises, approach your professor with some ideas you have and let him recommend some appropriate readings. Professors know their field well, so they should have no trouble pointing you towards some resources to help flesh out your initial thoughts. Second, as Qian Wen also advises, read your primary sources carefully. Grab a textbook or similar general source from the class and then skim through and look for angles that catch your attention, passages that make you ask why, or descriptions of competing arguments debating an interesting subject. Be imaginative and intuitive. Look for unusual connections between individuals, ideas, and broader themes, says Qian Wen. In general, the more care you take during this first step, the easier the rest of the paper writing process will be. So, take your topic choice seriously. Step 2. Conduct a thesis hunting expedition. Now that you've found a topic that excites you, you need to construct a thesis that makes a compelling argument concerning this topic. Once again, for a critical analysis essay, most of the work toward constructing your thesis has already been done for you. Typically, the essay prompt will contain a specific question, i.e., how do the two arguments differ, or why does the author say this? And your thesis is a summary of your answer. For a research paper, on the other hand, you might be dealing with a very broad topic that requires significant digging to find an interesting and supportable idea that can be expanded to fit the required page limit. In both cases, some initial research is required. A thesis devised from scratch is dangerous. Without some initial exploration, you have no idea whether or not your idea is viable. And there are few experiences worse than being forced to restart a paper after many hours of work. At the same time, however, you don't want to dedicate days to intensively reading every book in the field in search of a perfect thesis, because this would be inefficient. For a critical analysis essay, the solution is simple. Review both the reading notes and lecture notes that relate to the essay prompt. And that's it. This should provide a rough idea of how you are going to answer the question posed by the assignment. Therefore, your thesis has been found. Even though it's simple, don't skip this step for critical analysis essays. The earlier you develop an idea of what you are going to say, the more time you have to refine the nuances of your argument. For research papers, on the other hand, the task of finding a thesis is more complicated. No sources have been pre-selected for you, and no specific question has been provided. All you have is a general topic that you thought up yourself. Now you must wade into a vast sea of knowledge and somehow find enough material to devise a strong thesis while avoiding drowning in the sheer volume of available information. Not surprisingly, the straight-A students interviewed for this book have mastered the art of conducting research paper thesis hunting expeditions. Their goals are twofold. One, find an interesting thesis that can be supported within the scope of the assignment. And two, minimize the time required to conduct this search. Accomplishing both of these goals sounds hard, but straight-A students get it done. What's their secret? One simple phrase. Start general, then move one layer deep. Let's take a closer look at what this really means. Start general, then move one layer deep. I usually begin with basic sources, explains Chris, a straight-A student from Dartmouth. If I'm doing a paper on the Kurds in Turkey, for example, I get a recently published general history on this topic. Similarly, if your topic is Faulkner's early writing, you might find one or two Faulkner biographies and then focus only on the chapters dealing with his early years. If you have a hard time finding a few general sources for your topic, then ask your professor. He'll have plenty of titles to recommend. In addition, keep in mind that most courses set up a reserve shelf at the campus library. This shelf contains books that were selected by the professor because of their relevance to the course. Typically, you can check out reserve books for only a couple of hours at a time, so they should always be available to the students who need them. This is a great place to find general sources. So that's step one. The start general part of the strategy. The reason we need a second step is because you shouldn't expect to find your thesis idea in a general source. Of course, you might get lucky and find an interesting thesis during this first step. In general, however, overview sources will be much too broad to reveal a targeted and interesting argument that hasn't already been written about extensively. The main reason you found these general sources is to get at their bibliographies. As Chris goes on to explain, I read any chapters from my general sources that look useful for my paper. I then look up the sources used in that chapter. In other words, the second step of your thesis hunting expedition is to examine the list of books and articles cited in the relevant sections of your general sources. From this list, choose the cited works that look the most promising and then go find them in the library. These sources will be more focused, perhaps journal articles or books addressing only a small number of specific arguments. You are most likely to come across an interesting and appropriately targeted thesis idea using these more focused sources. Let's apply this approach to our Faulkner example from before. Perhaps one of our general sources cites a journal article on the influence of a specific European modernist writer on Faulkner. You find this journal article, and while reviewing it, you notice that it mentions in passing a list of other modernist writers who might have had a similar influence. Aha! Now this could be an interesting thesis. You might choose one of these modernists from the list and then look for historical evidence of their connection to the primary writer. Perhaps instead, one of the general sources talks about a period of Faulkner's life that he spent in Europe. Maybe it also mentions that our only records of this travel are letters written by the young author himself, and then it provides a citation to a collection of these letters. You then locate these letters, begin to read through them, and notice that he mentions a particular bar in London several times. This too might be a source of a fascinating thesis. You could investigate the intellectual climate of London night spots of the time and posit their potential influence on Faulkner's work. From there, perhaps the core of your paper could be to present a piece of writing from right before the trip and another from right after, and then argue which stylistic changes may have been influenced by his foray into the intellectual intensity of the London literary milieu. The key is to keep in mind that even very small observations can lead to large, interesting discussions. How do you know your thesis idea is good enough to support an insightful paper? A great thesis typically has at least these four qualities, explains Christine, a straight-A student from Harvard. It's provocative, nuanced, direct, and inclusive. She goes on to warn, a thesis should at the same time also show a grasp of the complexities of a subject. In this poem, X symbolizes Y because Z is a weak type of thesis structure, far too reductive and simplistic. Don't be afraid to leave room for ambiguity and unresolved issues. Wendy, a straight-A student from Amherst, puts it simply. The most important part of your paper is the thesis. Once you have a solid thesis, the rest just falls into place. Here's the tricky part. Your thesis will change and evolve as you continue the paper writing process. This is inevitable because you haven't done your exhaustive research yet. At this early stage, your thesis more likely explains the type of connection or answer you hope to find, rather than the final connections and answers themselves. To revisit our Faulkner example, your early research may indicate that the social milieu of a certain London night spot influenced a young Faulkner, but you might not yet know all the ways this influence was manifest. More research is required, and that's okay. You should embrace this evolution of your ideas as the process continues. For now, it's sufficient that your fledgling thesis looks like it's on the path toward fulfilling the properties mentioned previously. In other words, before continuing, make sure that your preliminary research strongly indicates that something similar to your thesis idea will be supported by the more detailed investigations to follow. Be honest with yourself. If you made up your thesis simply because it sounded cool, but have no real reason to believe it to be true, then you're courting a paper writing disaster. If, on the other hand, several pieces of early evidence point to the types of interesting connections described by your thesis, then you're on the right track. Step 3. Seek a second opinion. At this point, you should have an interesting topic and a targeted thesis. You're well on your way toward a standout paper, but don't get too far ahead of yourself. It's time to take a step back. More than a few students have dived deep into the paper writing process, supported by what they thought was a compelling thesis, only to find out, many pages later, that their premise was not as strong as it initially seemed. Perhaps they fail to find enough evidence to support the argument. Perhaps they stumble across another source that has already made the exact same point. Or, as is often the case, perhaps they find their thesis to be too broad to be succinctly argued within the scope of a paper assignment. The thesis hunting tips of the last step help eliminate this possibility, but they're not enough by themselves. Once you think you have a good thesis, a final step remains before diving fully into the research and writing process. As Riel, a straight-A student from Brown, explains, I often talk to a professor to clarify my ideas before I begin writing. This is great advice. For every research paper and significant critical analysis essay, i.e. assignments more than just a few pages long, you should make a habit of discussing your targeted thesis idea with your professor. Go to office hours or make an appointment, explain your topic and thesis, then ask the following questions. 1. Is my idea appropriate for the assignment? 2. Does it cover too much? 3. Is it too simple? For a critical analysis essay, if the professor deems your thesis appropriate, this is a good sign that you are not going to get stuck. You can now move ahead with confidence. For a research paper, if the professor deems your thesis appropriate, take advantage of this time to explain some of the sources you plan to examine. The professor will likely have some additional sources to suggest. Write these down. This just saved you some serious research time. For both types of papers, if the professor isn't enthusiastic about your thesis idea, then he or she will likely help you adjust it into something that is reasonable. When you leave this meeting, which should require only 10 to 20 minutes, you will have confidence in the foundation of your paper. You can now move full speed into the research stage without fear of reaching a devastating dead end later on in the process. It's amazing how many students ignore this incredible resource. One simple meeting can make the difference between a standout work and an incoherent dud. Remember, this step is not intended as a shortcut. If you skipped the previous step and show up at office hours without a targeted idea, the professor is not going to give you one for free. However, as Christine from Harvard explains, they'll rarely refuse to listen if they see you've thought things out in advance. Step 4. Research like a machine. Not surprisingly, research is the domain of the research paper. For a critical analysis essay, your sources are already specified, and there are probably only one or two of them. Therefore, when working on an essay, you can skip this step and move on to step 5, craft a powerful story, which describes how to organize your argument. For research papers, however, the following advice is crucial. Why? Because how you research can make or break your paper writing efforts. If your strategy is haphazard, as is the case with most students, then two immediate problems will arise. First, the writing process will become frustrating and tedious since you will be forced to continually stop and seek out new sources to extend your argument. Second, and more important, the resulting paper will be weak. A good argument requires a solid grasp of all relevant information. You want all the necessary facts and ideas to be at your fingertips, easily manipulated, sourced, and shuffled as you build your case. If your sources are incomplete and disorganized, then your paper will be too. On the other hand, you can also run the risk of spending too much time on research. Many eager students have succumbed to the horrors of research recursion syndrome, an unhealthy need to go find just one more source, often leading to hours and hours of wasted time, dorm rooms overwhelmed with teetering stacks of books, and one seriously sleep-deprived student. This is grind territory, and you should avoid it at all costs. So, while at first glance it may seem easier than choosing a thesis or writing the paper itself, in fact, the research step of paper writing is easy to get wrong. Fortunately, straight-A students have figured out a way to walk the research tightrope, getting the information they need without becoming lost amid the endless available sources. Their strategy can be summarized by a simple phrase: research like a machine. They follow a system, a mechanical process the same for every paper, that produces consistent, high